Good afternoon. This is Betsy Cannon-Smith, Class of 84, and I'm happy to welcome all of you to our final call in the 2009-10 Telephone Lecture Series. We're here in Professor Jessica Wolpar-Ray's office at Amherst College in Converse Hall, and Walter Nicholson, the Ward H. Patton Professor of Economics, will be joining us from Florida. This afternoon, they will discuss economic perspectives on healthcare reform. Walter Nicholson has taught at Amherst since 1968. He received his Ph.D. in economics from MIT after graduating from Williams College. Professor Nicholson's main research interests have centered on the evaluation of various social policies, especially unemployment compensation, job training programs, and welfare. He is also the author of two widely used texts in microeconomics. Professor Jessica Reyes was a student at Amherst in the class of 1994, majored in chemistry and mathematics, not in economics, and she didn't even take a single economics course. However, after Amherst, she received her Ph.D. in economics from Harvard and now specializes in the fields of public finance, labor economics, and health economics. Her current work focuses on public health and social impacts of environmental pollution, gender gaps in medicine, factors influencing judicial decision-making, and other topics in applied microeconomics. She's been teaching Econ 40, Health Economics and Policy, for the past 6 years, and is excited to be talking about actual healthcare reform rather than hypothetical reform. We hope you'll join us for the start of the 2010-11 lecture series in September, when we get rolling with Professor Goldsby talking about how stem cells would change your life and maybe save it. So please plan to join it and enjoy today's call. Great. Professor Nicholson, are you on the line and ready to start?
I'm ready to go. Okay, I'm Walter Nicholson. I thank the Alumni Association for setting this up and for all the interested alum who are listening. It's very nice that they would do this. Next time, maybe they'll provide a free lunch to us all. Let's hope. Okay, at any rate, we thought about this doing this a long time before anything was really passed, so we had a blank slate to think about. And decided we would start with some conceptualizations, which I'll do, and then turn it over to Jessica to talk a little more about the real world and what's actually going on. So I'm going to talk a little bit about healthcare from a purely economic perspective and start out by thinking about what healthcare would look like if there were no government involvement in it, if the government said hands off and we're not going to do anything about healthcare. To start any economic discussion, my favorite joke or favorite silly joke is you can teach a parrot to be an economist by teaching them just two words, supply and demand. So I'll start with supply and demand for healthcare. So if there were no government, obviously markets would allocate healthcare. The demand side of the coin would be derived from the important fact that nobody demands healthcare to have it themselves. What people really demand is health, and they demand health care for the purpose of securing health as best they can. We know quite a bit about the demand for health care based on a variety of path-breaking studies. We know it's not very price-responsive, but some parts of it are more price-responsive than others. And so, for example, things like dental and mental care are quite price-responsive, whereas surgery has almost no price responsiveness. We know it's fairly income responsive. People like to buy health care for their, people like their health, so they like to buy health care. So as people get wealthier, they tend to spend much more on health care. People are willing to spend quite a bit to stay healthy. So that's the demand side, really. And on the supply side, the health care market is mostly competitive, reasonably competitive. Doctor services and hospital services are reasonably competitive markets. The only non-competitive element in the story really is the drug side of the coin, where drugs, because of drug patents, have some degree of monopoly element in them, and that's worth thinking about. But mostly it's a competitive story. You always think in terms of supply about technical progress and how technical progress affects marketplaces. This particular marketplace is affected mainly because of the arrival of new products. New products come along all the time. We keep inventing new things. But interestingly, it's not characterized by what economists call labor-saving technology. In other words, there's not much substitution of capital for labor, so labor costs bulk large in medical costs. So with respect to general demand and supply influences, what we would expect over time is that probably the fraction of income spent on medical services would rise over time because as people get richer, they demand more of them, and they're not very price responsive to the rising prices. So certainly the amount spent on medical services would rise over time. That combined with the demographic feature that populations tend to get older means that you'd really expect to have rising share of GDP, say, devoted to medical care. Okay, the next topic on medical care is because some of it's uncertain, you never know when you might need something. Insurance plays an important role in all medical care. Many people would buy insurance without a government. People would buy insurance, and they would probably buy a wide variety of insurance depending on whether people's own risk preferences, whether they were willing to face the world uninsured and self-insure themselves for their medical expenses, or buy policies that would cover catastrophes or maybe somewhat less than catastrophes. So we would expect a wide variety of insurance policies depending on what kind people wanted to buy and what services they wished to have covered and what services they didn't wish to have covered on their medical policies. We'd also expect medical premiums for those insurance policies to vary dramatically because insurance companies would have to figure out what kind of risk they were exposed to by insuring a particular person. They'd want to do some kind of tests or whatever. And so you'd expect people who have pre-existing health conditions to pay a lot more than people without such health conditions. And finally, so the end result would be of a medical care market without government is you'd have a situation where incomes would go largely to determine health care. And so low-income people would have only limited access to care, if any at all. And people with serious medical conditions would pay very high insurance premiums. So that's that provides the realm for government intervention. A government might intervene in a market-oriented way, in which way, since it would, the government would think about providing insurance to low-income people in some way or other, and maybe insurance to, we already have, by the way, a program for low-income people, the Medicaid program. And it would provide maybe some special policies to people with serious medical conditions if we feel that that's kind of unfair that people with serious medical conditions should pay a lot for insurance. We'd have various kinds of programs, and there are a few government programs in that regard. There's the Black Lung Program, there's an end-stage renal program, and a few other programs like that. But generally, the government would not subsidize much health care for higher-income people. It wouldn't need to. People would be buying their own. And so, for example, current policies such as employer-provided health care would be taxed as income rather than provided with a subsidy, and the Medicare program would be targeted to only low-income people on the assumption that relatively more affluent, older people could afford their own health care. So that's what a market-oriented program would look like. I think the conclusion we reach is that does the current reform look that way, or where are we heading? And we'll let Jessica take up from there.
Thank you, Walter. So, hello. I wanted to thank the Alumni Office also for arranging this and say hello to everyone who's listening. I appreciate your interest in the subject. And as I said, as Betsy said in introducing me, I am excited to be talking about real reform. I was in the midst of discussing the state of the uninsured in March when healthcare reform passed, and it was pretty exciting to be able to come in, finish talking about the population is uninsured and what the consequences are, and then immediately be able to discuss reform that actually had happened, however imperfect, but to talk about something that actually happened. It made me feel a little older than I normally feel, in that I felt like I had been lecturing for years about possibilities for reform or failed reform, and now we have actual reform to talk about. So I really appreciate Walter having set the stage with the basic, the way economists think about these things. And economists do think about these topics generally approach anything in terms of efficiency and equity. We think about supply and demand, and then we think about what markets can accomplish. And we think that markets can usually, if they're working pretty well, achieve efficient outcomes, but they don't always achieve equitable outcomes. So we think about whether government should intervene in terms of, is there an efficiency problem that government could reasonably fix? And is there an equity problem? And could government fix that? In terms of reform, though, what I'd like to say, I'd like to frame my comments by thinking about, it's not really just a question of where we want to be as a society and whether we want to get to a particular point of a particular level of efficiency, a particular level of equity. It's a question of how we try to get there from where we are. And that's a complicated question, and that's part of why various reforms have not worked over the years, because they thought more about where we wanted to be than how we would get there. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this current reform, that it was very specific in trying to achieve change in particular ways. So what I want to do is start off by talking about where we are, the main issues that the system we have, the complex system we have, presents, and how reform tries to address those. So the major issues of health economics are really two major issues. The first is that costs are high. Walter referred to, we're spending a little more than a sixth of GDP on health care, and that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. We could think that's how we want to spend our money, and it could be certainly worth it. Another issue is that that share is growing pretty fast, and most predictions based on previous growth would be that that would reach about a third of GDP, a third of our income on such healthcare by the year 2040. We spend more on medical care than either food or housing, and we could think that that's a fine thing, but I want to talk about whether those costs are too high and how one thinks about what the costs should be and how we should think not just about costs but about the value we're getting. So while Walter said economists, you know, supply and demand is it, another thing that we talk about a lot, which are closely linked to supply and demand, is marginal benefit and marginal cost. What is something worth, some particular thing? So what we want to think about is not just how much care costs, but what it's worth to us, because something that's very expensive could be worth a lot, and we could still want to have it. The second problem after costs is access, that access is incomplete. And as Professor Nicholson referred to, we have a share of the population that lacks insurance for various reasons, and this leads to great inequities in access to insurance and care. There's a related problem to both of these. The quality of care is mixed and generally not incentivized. There isn't a lot of incentive in the system for providers to produce quality care. So what I want to do is just go through these two problems, cost and access, in turn, and then turn to reform. So costs, in terms of the growth of healthcare expenditures, we do spend more than other countries. So we're spending about 17 or 18% of GDP, where other countries are spending a maximum of 8% of GDP. And these costs are projected to grow to almost a third of GDP. Some of this is because of older populations. Some of it, as well, is because of income growth, that healthcare is a normal good. Some of it is improvements in quality. Some of it is how our payment system works. Overall, the costs are worth it, but they're still high, and it's not clear that all of the costs are worth it. The thing about this cost growth is that if we look, I don't know if anyone had a chance to read some of the reports. I'm not sure if this one got onto the list of readings, but the Council of Economic Advisers report in June, they had an interesting graph, and they're showing what family income would look like over the next 30 years, net of health insurance, if health insurance costs and healthcare costs kept growing the way they have been. And what they show is that basically all of the growth we would achieve in GDP would go towards paying for healthcare if we get the kind of expected economic growth we would expect, and if health insurance costs kept growing the way they would, meaning income, real income, would be flat we would be spending all of our new income on health insurance, which could be something we want to do. So that brings us to the question of whether these costs are worth it. And that question is a difficult one, so I want to think about it on different time frames and different margins. If we look back over the past 50 or 60 years, and we say, what would we give up? Would we want to go back to, say, 1950 healthcare at 1950 costs? Or would we rather have 2010 healthcare at 2010 costs? And economists have done this, and what we see is that from 1950 to now, we live about 9 years longer than we would have. So in 2010, we're living about 9 years longer than we would have in 1950. And that the cost increase to do that it was a pretty good deal. The total increase in cost of medical care was about $50,000 over a person's lifetime, and that gives us 9 more years of life, which, based on how economists calculate this, seems like a pretty good deal. So that would say, yes, these costs are worth it. Over time, they're worth it. But another way of comparing, by looking across areas of the country or looking across different countries, answers that question in the negative. And if we look, for example, at Medicare spending by state, it varies by a factor of 50% to 100% from state to state, with no discernible differences in health. So researchers at the Dartmouth Healthcare Initiative have looked at these variations in cost. And what they found, we had a great lecture, a guest lecture by Dr. Elliot Fisher, who is one of the principal investigators of the Dartmouth Healthcare Initiative, and he's a parent of a current student, Josie Fisher. So he came to give a guest lecture to our health economics class. And one of the main points he made was that when they look at these high-cost areas, what they see is that the type of extra care, where the extra costs are coming from, is from extra care that were unclear of what kind of health it produces. So on the kind of regular care that all doctors agree everyone should get, they don't spend more in the high-cost places. It's the same as the low-cost places. In the care where most doctors agree, it's still about the same. It's the care where there are big differences of opinion and it could go either way, the kind of discretionary care, that's where the high-cost areas are spending a lot. And the CEA report, building on the Dartmouth results, says that basically 30% of our healthcare costs could be eliminated with almost no cost to health if we were able to eliminate that care that is happening but shouldn't be happening. That's sort of our high-cost care but low-benefit care. So this then leads us to transform the question about whether the costs are worth it to what kind of value are we getting from the system. So it's not just do we want lower costs, it's how do we get the care and get the right value out of the system. So that's part one about cost. The second major issue with this current healthcare system in the United States and the provision of care is an access problem. We do have 70% of the population uninsured, about 50 million people, and they're uninsured for a variety of reasons, and I think that's something that actually the national debate and discussion over the last year or two has really accomplished in helping the public understand to a better degree why people are uninsured and the fact that the uninsured are a much more diverse group than they might have thought. So just to give you a quick picture of that, what happens if someone lacks insurance? They generally get, the quick way to put it is they get less care, they get late care, and they get worse care. The uninsured are not really poor necessarily, but they're also not really rich. They're working families with low incomes. They are mostly white, but minorities are twice as likely to be uninsured. They're not unemployed, and it's not that they're lacking workers. Most have at least one worker in the family. They just have workers in the family who don't get insurance through their jobs. Blue-collar jobs are much less likely to offer health insurance than white-collar jobs. So most people who are uninsured say they're uninsured because it's too expensive. They say they would like to be insured, but it's too expensive or not available to them in various ways. And employer-sponsored health insurance, which is really the centerpiece of our provision in the United States of insurance, has declined substantially in the last decade. It has become less available and just weakened on a variety of margins. Public insurance coverage has offset some of this loss, particularly for children, but it's been evolving, and we haven't really been making a lot of ground on reducing the share of the uninsured. So overall, where are we? We have a very imperfect system that's a complex combination of private and public provision. We have overconsumption of care in some ways. We have some. We have underconsumption in others, where some people are not getting access to care. It's just kind of out of whack in a variety of manners. And the fundamental problem is not really affordability. It's about value. It's about getting the most for the system out of the system, what we want as a society. And there is a dilemma of trying to address the cost problem and address the access problem at the same time. This then leads to a question that Walter raised about what then is government's role. So if this is another way of saying what does the situation look like, what is the appropriate role for government? Before we talk about what the healthcare reform is doing, what the new reform that is sort of evolving over the next 5 to 10 years, rolling out, is doing, we should talk about what government's role is now. And I think that is one thing that is not widely understood as clearly as it should be. How much does government actually spend now? What's interesting is that this has been downplayed, you can imagine why it would be downplayed, for political reasons, by both ends of the spectrum. But government at all levels is responsible for financing nearly 60% of healthcare costs in the U.S. So 60% of that 17% of GDP is being financed by government, either directly through direct purchasing of medical care, Medicare, Medicaid, government-owned hospitals, or indirectly through the tax deduction for health insurance, tax exemption for health insurance premiums, through public employee health benefits, nonprofit health care organizations, etc. So government in the U.S. is actually spending more on health care than Canada right now. It's not that we have government not involved. 60% of our high number is higher than most countries that we compare ourselves to who have single-payer national health care. So that changes our question of sort of what should government's role be. It brings back to people, there were some quotes from last summer, the people at town hall meetings saying to get government out of their Medicare, which clearly is not going to happen since Medicare is a government-funded program. But, and that's an extreme example, but government is already extensively involved in the health insurance system and in the health care system in a variety of ways, regulation, provision, etc. So it's not necessarily a question when we think about reform of how should government get involved. It's how do we want to change government's involvement. That then brings us to the question of what is the political landscape? What is the situation in which reform would happen? And Americans' views on healthcare, on healthcare reform, are quite conflicted, as one could understand quite easily from the debate that's happened. But they're conflicted in particular ways. Generally, people are satisfied with their own current medical arrangements, but they're dissatisfied with the system more broadly and with managed care and private health insurance. They have general support for a national health plan or national health care reform, but when it comes down to specifics, they don't trust government to do the right thing, and they don't favor a single-payer type of health plan. People express a general belief in universal coverage, but they are not willing to sacrifice much for universal coverage. So it's a complex tension between a commitment to some kind of basic equity and a societal commitment to health care or some basic level of health care for all, with an American, a particularly American sense of individual freedom and responsibility for one's own self. So that's the context in which this has happened. So what is the case for healthcare reform? Why reform, and why this now, this kind of reform? The main pieces of the reform are, one, to expand coverage, and two, to reduce cost. Now, the expand coverage part is the part that has gotten the most play. And if you think about the way President Obama, through the campaign, when he was candidate, and in the last year, has presented reform, he doesn't even start with the expand coverage part. He always started with the statement, if you have health insurance that you're happy with, you can keep it. Nothing will change other than you will be paying less for it. So he starts with stability and then says, let's stick with stability and then move on to expanding coverage, and doesn't really mention the reducing cost thing because people are afraid of reducing cost. But the two main elements are not the let's keep things the same. They are expand coverage and reduce cost. The way this reform expands coverage is through increasing access, through subsidies. If people find health insurance not affordable, and those are subsidies, generally people can be expected under these plans to pay up to about 8 or 9% of their income for health insurance. And beyond that, the government is subsidizing in various ways. Through the creation of markets, because right now we don't really have well-functioning markets for individuals to go out and purchase health insurance, partially because of what Professor Nicholson said about the fact that the people who would go out seeking insurance are the people who most need it and who are sickest, and therefore the health insurance companies are wary of taking them on. So there are ways of making these markets and making the insurance companies take everybody and of subsidizing these purchases. So that's the access piece. The other part is compulsion on individuals. There's an individual mandate to get insurance, and compulsion on employers to continue offering coverage so that employers don't stop offering coverage and expect people to kind of just go get it in the other markets. There are various fines for employers if their employees start getting coverage elsewhere. The second part, the reduced cost piece, is really has not been discussed a lot, but it's through insurance competition. It's through various reforms of Medicare that will hopefully spill over into other types of insurance, and through new provision arrangements, new ways of thinking about how do you produce health care, how do doctors and other providers work together to produce care that is what we want it to look like and that is much more efficient, rather than the segmented and really fragmented market that we have now. So the main elements of this healthcare reform are affordability, accessibility, cost and quality improvement, and really a combination of regulation and incentives, trying to get the incentives right so that the incentives lead to the production of health. I think people are pretty aware of what the access and the compulsion parts are. But what I'd like to do is just take a last moment to talk about what is in this healthcare reform in terms of cost control, because that it's all in there, but it hasn't been discussed as much in the public discussion. What's included, as I said, the insurance exchanges, monitoring of Medicare, and some information technology pieces are directly included in trying to improve, reduce costs, and improve the efficiency of the system. Things that are partially included are trying to reduce prices, trying to pay for value, change the way Medicare pays for things so that we're paying for things that produce health rather than just paying for things that are expensive and don't necessarily produce health. Trying to experiment with these new care provision arrangements, and that's what Dr. Fisher was talking to us a good deal about from the Dartmouth Healthcare Initiative, that they are experimenting with new ways of arranging care so that there's not as much duplication, better communication, and trying to eliminate those excess costs. There's some taxation of generous plans, which people have heard about a lot. There's small pieces of moving towards malpractice reform, and there's an emphasis on preventative care. Things that are not included that could possibly have helped costs are a public option, meaning a government-provided health insurance program that is competing with the private programs on these health insurance exchanges. Changes to how drugs are purchased, and some kind of standardization of plans and payments. But what's interesting about this reform is that it does include a lot of the ideas that health economists and policy analysts have had for how to constrain cost growth. And what the CEA argues is that if we think about that cost growth over time, and we think about, say, a 7% rate of cost growth from one year to the next, if we can reduce that by 1 percentage point, we can, 1 percentage point less growth doesn't sound like a lot. But if you can do that over a 30-year period, then 30 years later, your costs are a third lower than they would have been otherwise. So it's trying to make modest changes to achieve big benefits in the long run. So what this reform is trying to accomplish overall is to address the access and the cost problems, to create functioning markets for individual and small business purchase of insurance, to achieve near universal and affordable coverage. The predictions are that 95% of Americans will have health insurance coverage, paying less than 10% of their income for that coverage. It would substantially increase the size of Medicaid, extending Medicaid to all poor people, not just poor elderly and poor kids. It would inhibit the loss and denial of coverage. It would try to move towards paying for value to encourage preventative care and try to realign incentives that would hopefully reduce costs substantially. So we look forward to your questions, and I hope that this has been somewhat interesting. Thanks.
Great. Thank you both. And we actually have some nice questions queued up already. So I'll begin. First question. Through the new health care bill, we are covering all the uninsured and providing for their health care needs. Are there any responsibilities those receiving health care will have to uphold? That is, eating healthy, not drinking excessively, following doctor's advice, and understanding it's not free.
Let me start by commenting briefly on the health reform, since I didn't do that before. Clearly, the health reform package increases access in a variety of ways, and that, I said, was a proper role of government. The notion of controlling costs, to me, is pure fluff. There is no controlling cost. And, in fact, the only way to control cost, really, is to give people an incentive to do so themselves. And there's almost none of that in this health care bill. So the in answer to this specific question, I don't think there is any incentive in this for lower income people to try to do anything that that's cost reducing. I don't know what exactly the provisions are, for example, for coinsurance or deductibles. That's the traditional way of getting people who are insured to take some degree of price responsiveness into account. I believe the most of the policies have very low coinsurance rates and probably almost no deductibles. So I don't think there's any cost control on the low income population, and I expect the government budgets will expand dramatically to cover these groups. Now, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but to expect you're going to have some kind of cost control through the kind of stuff that's in this bill is, I think, extremely unlikely.
Well, my ideas about cost control are that a lot of the decisions that are being made within the context of physicians and other healthcare providers working together and them deciding what to do and what not to do. So I think that some of the changes in Medicare's reimbursement towards trying to pay for things that produce health effectively and at relatively low cost and standardization of that may lead to these kinds of reductions and to more efficient care, particularly because Medicare does serve as kind of a focal point and a leader for setting these reimbursement rates. In terms of preventative care, I think there are separate initiatives trying to get people to consider their health more. They are not at all linked to, certainly, to you get insurance, you have to do this stuff to get insurance. But there are changes in the Medicaid reimbursement rates that could be particularly helpful in terms of changing those Medicaid reimbursement rates so that Medicaid is actually giving people better access to preventative care. A good example of this is health clinics and various organizations trying to combat diabetes and the consequences of diabetes. One of the best things to do, or the least expensive things to do, is sort of ongoing nutritional counseling to try to improve someone's health. And people, this takes time and it takes effort, But it's much better for the individual if they can learn to do that. And it avoids things like a foot amputation 2 years down the line. Now, currently, many health insurance programs, Medicaid included, will definitely pay for the foot amputation, but won't necessarily pay very well for the nutritional counseling that could avoid that. So I think there are some changes in trying to increase the payments to primary care providers, to reduce some of the payments to specialists, to try to lead to more of a preventative mindset. So it's not an individual obligation, but it's trying to change the incentives in the system to move more towards preventing illness rather than just cleaning up after the fact.
Great. Now we'll shift to a little bit to higher education. This question, I'm wondering whether Professor Reyes and Nicholson think that some of the cost problems in higher education are analogous to those in the healthcare system. In both cases, the full cost of the service is not borne by the consumer. Decision makers are not incented to control costs or increase productivity, and taxes compound the problem, that is, tax-free status of schools and their endowments. Thoughts on that?
I'll plunge in and say there's not much more to say. The questioner got it completely right. There's all sorts of cost increasing incentives in higher education also that are very similar to the healthcare. I would also point out that the nature of the industry is similar. There's a notion in economics called the Baumol disease. The Baumol disease arises when industries are highly labor intensive and there's no possibility of substituting capital for labor. Baumol first noticed it in the arts, where you can't substitute scenery for opera singers. But it's certainly it applies to healthcare in many ways, and it certainly applies to higher education. So I think the analogy is pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that economists try to let the markets work and see how far they can go and get the prices right so that people are paying for what they get and getting what they pay for. And we generally think that when you break those links between what people have to pay and what they get, you cause problems. Sometimes we think that that's okay. There's some greater good. And in healthcare, we think, or in education, in both of those, we think maybe it should be not based on ability to pay or willingness to pay. Maybe we should try to do some redistribution. But we are doing redistribution, and redistribution is costly in a variety of ways because it changes people's incentives, and it just kind of messes up the markets. And we generally think that efficient markets, well-functioning markets, lead to efficient outcomes, which mean they maximize total welfare of everybody. And when you move away from that, there's a cost to doing so. You may say, that's okay, I'd like to give up something. I'd like to reduce the size of the pie to make it more evenly distributed. But there is always that trade-off between the two.
Great, thank you. We'll shift on to a two-part question here. What are the key drivers of the difference between our 17% of GDP and the maximum 8% in other countries? Is it the high-cost, low-benefit care we're consuming? And it continues, to what extent is the problem resulting from relatively wealthy people spending a great deal on the margin for relatively little benefit? Does this include elective care for things like cosmetic plastic surgery? How does the relative cost picture change if we exclude such elective luxury care? As a society, are we spending relatively more per capita and per GDP on luxury care than other countries, but relatively less on basic care? And is the opposition to reform coming from relatively affluent people who don't want to give up their luxury care options in order to make room for more basic care for the un- and underinsured people?
If that's okay, Walter, I'll jump in on this one. I don't really have an answer, like, oh yes or oh no. I think that when people look at our high costs relative to other countries, one of the big things is we don't really have more health to show for it. Our infant mortality rate or life expectancy, things like that, they're not that much better, and in some cases they're worse. So we don't have a lot of health to show for it. So what do we have to show for it? it may not necessarily just be luxury care. Yes, that may be part of it, but it's also just things that are happening, other types, the kinds of things that the Dartmouth Healthcare Atlas has tried to, that they've tried to separate out, MRIs, x-rays, a lot of various things that are just happening that shouldn't necessarily be happening. So it's a difficult question. It's actually one that I was just talking last week with a student, Nick Hodges, who's going to be a senior next year and is considering looking at this kind of question as part of his senior thesis in economics.
The international comparisons are difficult, and there's a whole gigantic literature on them. First thing I'd say is I don't think the 8% really is the maximum of other countries. I think some other countries are up around 10, 12% of GDP. So I'm not sure the U.S. is double every other country. And I also want to point out on the statistics side of what health we get, although our life expectancy and our infant mortality rates don't look that good relative to other countries, we look much better on other statistics, particularly on such things as 5-year survival rates for cancer patients, where I think we lead the world, and the reduction in heart disease in the United States, I think, leads the world. So, so whether we get a lot for our money or not, I'm not as negative as other observers are. I think it's a very complicated question. There's a lot to do with the population mix we have vis-a-vis other countries, and the other issues about the nature of our population. So people have tried to look at this pretty complicated, and I think it's probably oversimplistic to say it's that we have a lot of really luxury care. I'm not sure that's exactly the case. But anyway, these are very difficult comparisons, and we have a higher GDP than most other countries, GDP per capita, so it's not unexpected that we would spend more, given that healthcare is a normal good. So I don't know. I'm not as taken by the fact we overspend as everybody else seems to be.
I think it's just very difficult if we say any care is excess care, to figure out which care it is. So there was, I was reading in some Atul Gawande piece about going through a hospital with another journalist saying, so which of these patients, or with a doctor saying, so which three out of these 10 patients is getting care that they shouldn't be getting? And so it's really hard to figure out why our costs are high and exactly what we're getting for that or not.
One thing about the Dartmouth people, by the way, my co-author of my micro textbook is a professor at Dartmouth, and he has endless arguments with the Dartmouth people over incentives, and the Dartmouth people talk about all this notion of people doing things that are unnecessary and all that, but they almost never focus on why that's happening.
But I think they are thinking about it now, but maybe that's...
They need more economics.
Yeah.
The Dartmouth group.
All right, well, we'll move on to another question. This question is reminding us how small Amherst is and how much everyone knows one another. Sid and Judy say hello to Jessica's parents. And then, next, I agree that there is much to be saved by eliminating futile or valueless care. The problem is defining it, on the one hand, and even more difficult, to get public buy-in on the other. The debate over reform has shown how nearly impossible it will be. Death panels, government takeover, tossing overboard the public option. So in practical terms, do you think it's actually possible, given the coarseness and demagoguery of our politics, to get to meaningful reform that would seriously address these issues? It seems to me that the only viable model in the long run will be a single-payer system, which will allow significant controls and which will eliminate the siphoning off of money by hundreds of insurance companies. Do you agree? Is it possible to get there before we collapse economically?
That was kind of a big government pitch. I'm not a big government person. I'm a small government person who believes markets would work better if they were given a chance, if we didn't subsidize healthcare on all sorts of dimensions. But at any rate, I think that the notion that we can somehow get ourselves out of this problem by expanding our healthcare to look like other countries our government role in healthcare, looking at other countries, is extremely dubious. Every country has problems with its healthcare system. Every country has big arguments about what's going on. And this, for example, the Canadian system has lots of problems right now, and there's extreme political debate over it. As for the similar for the British system, so I think it's a mirage to say if we just had a single payer system, everything would be hunky dory.
Yeah, hello, Sid. I don't think that I've thought as much directly about single payer, just because I am kind of stuck on this, how do we get there from here? So it just seems that politically, if we look back at what was discussed, say, in the Clinton reform, the failed reform, the substance of it was actually pretty similar to the reform that just passed. But what was different was the way it was couched and the way it was done in terms of being incremental reform and trying to really clearly build on what we have and not, I mean, although it's seen as a huge change, it's trying to build on what we have, which, yeah, if we were starting from scratch, we would do something possibly completely different. We might do a Walter-style, you know, just minimal intervention, or we might say, let's just take over the whole thing. I would probably, if we were starting from scratch, do, I don't know, I don't even know what I would say to that. But I think that what's been interesting about this debate is that despite the demagoguery on both sides, we have been able to get what I think is meaningful reform. There are some big pieces missing. But I think the big question that's yet to be determined is how all this changing of the incentives inside the stuff that's in the bill that hasn't really been discussed, that people are going out trying to look at best practices, whole organizations that are organized to produce high-quality care at relatively low cost, identifying those organizations, figuring out what they are doing differently, how they are setting up their incentives differently for their providers. If we're able to do that, make that kind of change, and I think the system is set up to do that, then we may be able to move forward. It's not that it's the optimal way to move forward, but I think it's pretty good given what we've got now and the problems that we do have now.
Thank you. Next question. What do you think to reduce demand of rationing care?
I guess what rationing care means is we have some, it's similar to what Oregon does, for example. Oregon has a list of 490 things it might cover by its health insurance program, and it decides it only has the money to cover 375, so it says it won't cover the other 120. We could certainly do that as a society. I'm more of a libertarian and free market person that thinks that forbidding people to get certain kinds of care is a bad idea. But it may well come to that if we have a large government representation in the area, and the budget is getting tough. I mean, that's what Oregon did. Oregon reduced the number of services it covered in response to budgetary pressures. So I can certainly see that coming, but I would not think it's a desirable state of affairs.
I would actually take the question and say that rationing just happens all the time, and economists tend to think about markets are kind of a good way to ration something. That's a different use of the word rationing, but it's a way of allocating the care across people, and we generally think we like prices to do that. But I think the thing that I'd like to point out is that every system rations, every system distributes care in some manner. Now, that could be in a top-down manner where the government says, you get this and you get that and you don't get that. Or it could be a system where, you know, you can pay for this and you can't pay for it, so you don't get it. Or it could be what we have now, which is this complex thing about people have insurance or they don't have insurance or they find some other way to pay for it and their insurance is subsidized or it's not, indirectly or directly. So these decisions about who gets what are being made implicitly through our system in a complex and inequitable manner. So in a sense, stepping up and saying we're going to ration care, I think is a more direct way to do it and possibly more equitable, but leads you into a huge minefield of actually explicitly making those decisions, which are incredibly difficult decisions to make. So I don't know where to go with that.
This moves us into the pharmaceutical industry. As an oncologist, I find myself prescribing incredibly expensive biotechnology drugs, which are exciting but priced well into the six-figure range for a single drug. How do economists view the pharmaceutical industry's role in the overall picture of cost-benefit?
Well, economists, there's a clear theory of patenting, why one needs patents. So the beneficial side of patents is they foster innovation. And the downside of patents is they create monopolies where the drug holder can price whatever the market will bear. So any patent policy has to have a trade-off between the incentives of innovation versus the loss from monopolization. And it's a very complicated story, and it well could be the case that drug patents are too generous at the moment to drug companies. I haven't studied that in detail, but it seems to me a possibility. There have been a number of slight weakenings of the drug patent law to allow for generics and things like that at earlier stages. But we have to recognize that drug invention is a very costly process, and that drugs that have been invented have been extremely productive. I mentioned before the decline in heart disease. That's almost exclusively a drug-driven phenomenon, although there may be some exercise element too. But the drugs have been incredibly productive. So, I think you tamper with the drug system at your peril, but probably it's worth thinking about a bit.
Great. We may have time for one, maybe two more questions. From a former student of Professor Nicholson's, the question comes, is there pressure to monopolize healthcare state to state? Are there ways to mitigate such pressures in the current legislation?
I don't think the healthcare market is monopolized. I mean, doctors and hospitals are pretty competitive. I think
health insurance.
There are these numbers that some states have only one or two insurance providers. Interestingly, often those insurance providers are nonprofits, mainly the Blue Cross Blue Shield and Kaiser. But many state markets are not as competitive as they should be, in part because of regulation that keeps smaller companies out of the business. So there might be something to be said for trying to make insurance markets more competitive, maybe through interstate competition. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there is a growing body of evidence that insurance companies are pricing, economists would say they're sort of upcharging, pricing above their cost more when they can, which is, we find, is an indication of their market power and the fact that they have some monopoly power. So I think there is, in the current reform, this creation of the health insurance exchanges at a state level where there'll be a few players, hopefully, does provide some degree of competition. Not as much as it would have been if there were, in addition, a public player in those markets. But I agree with Professor Nicholson on the separation of the healthcare markets, which are reasonably competitive, although with managed care organizations, doctors and hospitals have been kind of banding together to try to get their own market power, but they're reasonably competitive, and the health insurance markets, which are not really seen as being competitive.
And our last question, how important is malpractice tort reform?
Walter, I'll let you take that.
You hear a lot about it, and clearly, in some cases, it's important. I mean, there are these cases of states that have unfavorable tort laws and people leaving the medical profession in state X because its tort law is so unfavorable. I think the people who've looked at it conclude it's not a huge element of cost.
Yeah.
So that whereas some kind of tort reform would probably make sense, and deterring frivolous lawsuits is always a good idea. I think quantitatively it's not that big a deal, but I don't know what kind of numbers people come up with on it.
I think the kind of numbers people come, the direct cost of malpractice reform are sort of in the 2% range, And then the bigger numbers can get up in the 10%, 5-10% of cost range if people start including a lot of defensive medicine where doctors are doing tests and doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do. They're just doing it to kind of make sure they've covered their bases. So it is a question. It's hard to know how to respond to that because most of our evidence on malpractice shows that patients sue not when there's negligence. They have a hard time figuring out whether there was negligence. They tend to sue when something goes wrong, but it's with an expectation that doctors can be perfect, and doctors sort of realize that they can't be perfect. So it is a really difficult question to answer about
one, what... One other useful insight about this kind of thing is suppose we could have medical malpractice reform that would reduce the price of medicine, medical care by 5%, which is most anybody ever thought of. Even if you did that, that's just 1 year's worth of growth of medical costs. So a one-shot thing like that never can have a big cost effect because it's the overall trend of medical spending that's the big issue.
Yeah, it's about the growth. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Walter and Jessica. Thank you for the excellent questions. I apologize we did not get to all of them. There were many, many good questions. There are recommended readings on the website. This will be posted. The audio of this call will be posted to the college's website within the week, probably tomorrow. So you can go back and listen again to what you may have missed. And we thank you for joining us, and we'll sign off from a beautiful day here in Amherst and I think sunny Florida too, Walter, right?
Yes, indeed.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.